Now, I don't think it'll have any impact on tracking or reporting, but what it could do is prevent the agency from picking a particular pesticide or a category of pesticides and saying, let's solve that problem. So, for example, if you have a Clean Water Act total maximum daily load cleanup plan, which is required under the Federal Clean Water Act for pesticide-impaired water bodies, and the impairment is caused by organophosphate pesticides, that language could prevent NRCS from saying, okay, let's pay growers to switch away from OP pesticides. If under that language, if I was a pesticide manufacturer, I could come in and say, whoa, whoa, you're discriminating against my products.
Could you get around that, though, with the reduced risk idea for as well? Where you just say, no, you only want products that are on the reduced risk and replacement guidelines, whatever. You're not saying specifically you don't want to fight your growers, you don't want OPs, but
that might, but that would reduce your ability to go after the one chemical or the category of chemicals that you really want to focus on.
If I may add a comment, I've looked at that, and to me, minimally, it muddles the waters tremendously. So when you're trying to build partnerships and moving on those fronts, there's one more thing they have to consider as you're trying to develop these relationships, and that's at a minimum of my particular fear of that amendment.
Mike, can I offer two pieces of information? One is, if there's the genesis of how this whole thing came up, irrespective of whether you consider it a good or bad idea, which I don't agree with. The genesis of it was an action under CS, Customer Security Program, where under that program, I don't know if it was a state office or a local office, you may know it, Jonathan. OPRA was that they could not use atrazine in any circumstances in any other contract. The magistrates in Jenta said, wait a second, if they're using it according to the label, why are you taxpayer dollars to tell people not to use things for illegal reasons? And they registered protest with the USC's office in Washington. It wouldn't surprise, so there was some experience in the pesticide industry with that kind of situation. Whether in fact that was the exact genesis of it or not, that was certainly an experience in the industry there. So if that's what they want to do, it's a good one. But the other thing from Dave's point of view, we've been real careful. We were told early on in our programs that prior to this Good Light Amendment being adopted on our side, that it made more sense in terms of providing the incentive payment to say what growers were going to do, that NRCS did not want to be in the position of choosing one pesticide versus another. This is a little more risk, this is a little bit higher risk. And since some pesticides pose dietary risk from neurological risk or other ways around, NRCS people want to be in a position of choosing one, making pesticide efforts expensive, but it could be used if they use it according to their own condition. So what we've done, I think, in all lower the states, is talk about what it is the goal is doing that justifies the resource benefit that we get from a specific practice. I sure hope that's not
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the question is, the context is we are giving public funds to private for-profit entities, and should we be doing that if it's perpetuating an environmental problem, and should we not should we force the agency to not be able to or prevent the agency from being able to get in there and solve specific problems? There was a great example in Ohio, and I actually sort of glossed through this, but There have been several very exciting success stories around the country, and we've heard about Michigan today, we've heard about your work, Larry. One of these other states is Ohio, where the city of Columbus's drinking water reservoir was contaminated with atrazine. The city was facing, you know, the gauntlet of having to build a new treatment plant to deal with this. And instead, the city went to NRCS and launched, you know, an EQIP program that was tailored to atrazine and targeted to the growers surrounding this watershed. And, you know, over several thousand acres, growers bought into the program and reduced their atrazine use, adopted best management practices, and over a couple of years, drastically lowered the atrazine levels in the drinking water, saving the city millions of dollars in avoided treatment costs, right? It's exactly the kind of story that we all want to hear about. But I think that that would arguably be discriminating against atrazine under this language.
Okay. Jonathan, thank you very much.
And the quality of life results from the study that Luis Fernando just introduced to all of you. And I would especially like to thank and acknowledge the presence of Olga Lucia Sarmiento, who's in the audience. And she was the lead researcher for this quality of life component and also main author of this presentation. So I have to give her a lot of credit for that. Studies on the built environment and quality of life have been mainly conducted in developed countries and have been focused on self-reported health. There are evident differences between developed and developing countries with regards to health priorities, socioeconomic, cultural, and environmental contexts, and these highlight the needs to explore these issues in developing countries to better guide and understand policies aimed at improving well-being of the citizens. And also, as Luis Fernando already mentioned, and I'm not going to go into detail, the rapid urbanization processes that are taking place in Latin America are also very important to consider. The objective of this quality of life part of the study was to assess the association between health-related quality of life with built environment characteristics and physical activity among Bogota adults. Dr. Or Luis Fernando, he asked me not to call him doctor, already explained the methodological aspects of this study, and I'm not going to go into detail, but just to remind all of you that this was a multi-stage stratified study, and the sample size for this quality of life component was 1,285 participants. We have several outcome variables for this part of the study. One of them was a continuous score obtained from a modified and culturally adapted version of the World Health Organization Quality of Life Brief Survey. And we also have the question of how positive do you feel about the future, which was part of this questionnaire, and was used as an independent variable and dichotomized into positive, very positive, versus not at all, a little, and more or less. We also have the CDC Healthy Days questionnaire, which asks how many days were you sick during the last month, and we dichotomized this into 0 days versus 1 or more days. And finally, we use the Perceived Health Status Survey from the CDC, which asks 4 questions, and this was coded as excellent, good versus fair, poor, or very poor. The built environment characteristics, like as Luis Fernando already explained to you, were obtained using geographic information systems, and it had indicators from the dimensions of density, diversity, design, and access to mass transportation system, particularly Transmillennium, which was already presented by Luis Fernando. Each of these variables was measured in 3 different buffers, one 500 meters from the center of the block, the other one within the neighborhood, and finally 1,000 meters from the neighborhood boundaries. The individual variables used in this part of the study were gender, age, education, marital status, which was classified as having a partner versus not having a partner, main occupational activity during the last month, which was defined as working or studying versus home activities, searching for a job, or being retired. Socioeconomic status was based on the neighborhood socioeconomic strata, and was classified as one or two, which corresponds to low